The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside Q&A edition. That sounds, I guess, we're back with Aaron Kobernick. Aaron, does Q&A edition sound a little bit like a CSI spinoff or something? Is this?
Well, I love CSI, so let's get after it.
That sounds great. Do it. Yeah, let's. So this is Q&A Salt Lake City. It doesn't have a ring. We can work on it. Hey, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Paul. Very well. How are you?
Just fine, thanks. Good to talk to you again. I've heard lots of nice things about the conversation we had. People always are very intrigued by the sorts of things you have to say. So thanks so much for sharing your expertise and your ability to talk well about your expertise.
Well, thank you. It's a nice compliment and I appreciate it. And glad to be here. Glad to be a part of it.
Aaron, have you developed any conflict since we talked last time?
No, nothing relevant.
Okay, ready to dive into the questions?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're in the speed round now, and so there may be some upper times tables and state capitals. So brace yourself.
Good.
Okay. First question actually comes from Amara Finch, who's the person who requested the topic originally, and she A said thanks for your work, and B came in with a very nice question. So I will read that to you. Given the importance of cultivating a healthy microbiome for prevention of allergic and autoimmune disease, I'm inclined to recommend that pediatric patients are exposed to a variety of probiotic foods. While studies investigating the use of single-strain probiotics have been equivocal, evidence suggests that fermented foods may be protective even in the setting of COVID. Is there any harm in encouraging fermented foods, including kimchi, sauerkraut, and the like? Are there any contraindications to such foods in the pediatric population?
Well, so I love the question, and I think that it is asked perfectly, because I think that the question is not, can these foods that are rich in probiotics, are they going to help in some way? Because the answer there is definitely maybe. The question is, will I harm my patients by recommending these foods? And what I can very clearly tell you, and I think we'll all agree, there's no evidence that any of these foods are harmful in any sort of way to our health. The evidence that favors use of probiotics, I mean, this is again, kind of getting back to the conversation we had initially, which is that we know that probiotics, we know that bacteria are helpful and an essential component of who we are, and they help us build robust immunity, they help us tolerate and digest foods, and we know that's true. We don't have the specific formula dialed in, and I think that that's the key piece. Now, as we move forward, we're going to know more and more about what that specific bacterial fingerprint should look like. But now, in a world where we don't know, what we do know is that there's no harm that's ever been identified or even suggested in terms of eating foods that are rich in probiotics. You know, certainly my experience, so I can't tell you that it's something that we should universally recommend. And certainly if it was something where there was robust data, the American Academy of Pediatrics would be recommending it as well. But what I can tell you is that in my experience, you know, I do see a lot of patients with gut health issues and the like, and many have told me that a diet rich in probiotics seems to be helpful. You know, again, things like kimchi or kombucha or whatever it is. I've had many patients tell me that's helpful. I can't specifically recommend anything in particular. So to answer the question, I can't specifically recommend people do it. I wouldn't say everyone needs to go out and buy a bunch of kimchi, but certainly this is not something that is likely to be harmful.
No, it's interesting because I think a lot of what our conversation about the microbiome has centered around is what's happened in the microbiome because of subtraction. You know, what are the things that have made us have a less robust microbiome? And some of that is exposures to things, and some of it is antibiotic use. And it is interesting to think in terms of, are there bricks that we need to add back in, or is the whole construction project something we need to address?
I think you're nailing it there too, because it's a lot easier to fixing the problem is a lot harder than not having the problem to begin with. So you're nailing it there too. So what does that mean? What do I mean by that? Well, just like we were talking about, that means a rich exposure to a variety of biota in the environment. And whether that's an accumulation of bacteria as a baby passes through the birth canal, whether that's breastfeeding, whether that's being outdoors, whether that's being near animals, all of those things seem to be helpful. And at the same time, the things that seem to be harmful to the microbiome, you nailed it. I mean, it's antibiotics primarily, but it's also just a lack of kind of exposure to different things. So both, I would say. So robust biotic exposure, crucially important. Lack of antibiotics, crucially important. Now, antibiotics, we need them. We know we need them. But we also, you know, grew very accustomed to prescribing them probably more than we needed to. And it's interesting, even in my career, which hasn't, I don't think, been too long, but, you know, maybe it's getting longer every year. But even in the last, 15 years since I was a resident, I remember parents coming in and asking for antibiotics for ear infections, whereas in kind of today's world, the question is different that I'm asked by a parent. It's more of, does my child absolutely need this antibiotic? Because I don't really want to give that. So I think that message has gotten into the community, and I think it's a good one, and I think it's the right thing.
The other question that we have is in many ways a related question, as makes perfect sense. And that's, what's the role of pets in immune development and allergy development and prevention?
So this is another great question. I love this question. So let's kind of talk through this, and let's talk about that Amish study again, and talk about the kind of importance of the farm, or what we think is innate immunity and innate immune activation in terms of preventing allergy. And then we'll talk about what research has been done to look at pet exposure and development of allergic or atopic disease. So again, to kind of recap from the previous conversation, when the Amish people were found to have very low rates of atopy, the prevailing theory there is that it's because of innate immune activation. And innate immune activation comes at least in part through activation of LPS, using LPS, which is that chemical, that protein found in a bacterial, or a carbohydrate, more appropriately, found in bacterial cell walls. So in Amish houses, they're very close to the barnyard, and so there is a lot of bacteria. And a lot of bacteria close to the house means a lot of bacteria in the house, and they're not using machines, they're using animals, so they're around these animals all the time. We see high levels of LPS in the house. We see then innate immune activation. And when innate immunity is activated, atopy just doesn't want to develop. And that was proven with the mouse studies and everything else. So the question here asks specifically, well, what about pets? So we can't all live on a farm and have a barnyard next door and prevent atopy for our children in that way. But what about pets? What about a dog? What about a cat? And the answer is, in short, that it is thought to help. Now, this has been studied kind of in a variety of different ways, unfortunately, mostly retrospective and, you know, kind of asking the question, well, okay, we haven't necessarily done a prospective study here and said, okay, we're going to randomize people and put a third with cats, third with dogs, and a third with no pets and see who develops atopy. But the question's been asked retrospectively. Okay, you're 9 years old, you have atopic disease, did you have a pet growing up? So it's not perfect in terms of the data, but the answer, even given that lack of perfection, seems to be relatively consistent, and we do have a plausible mechanism. And the answer is that essentially dogs seem to prevent development of atopy, cats to a lesser extent. And dogs, and you know, when this was first looked at, and I don't know when it was first looked at, but when it was looked at most seriously, probably in the early 2000s, that's what was found, is it looks like there's a trend towards lack of atopy when there's a dog in the house. Why does that happen? Well, again, we have this plausible mechanism. Dogs, who I love, doesn't change the fact that they have bacteria all over them, and they're, you know, they're not the cleanest of animals. And so that bacteria is all over the house. We get LPS exposure. That means innate immune activation is there, and ATP hopefully is prevented. Now, interestingly, these studies tend to look at presence of a pet in the home for the first year of life. And I agree with that because, you know, what we see after that first year of life, that first year is just so crucial. So you really need that early exposure in order to prevent ATP. Now, one study looked at this more recently, I believe a few years ago. And what they did there is they said, well, okay, so we've got this theory and we still are going to do this retrospectively, but we're going to ask people, we're going to see if they're atopic, and then we're going to go back and we're going to say, well, not only did you have a pet in the house, yes or no, but how many? And because maybe there's a, if we can show that there's a dose dependence here, in other words, if more pets makes you less atopic, well, then that strengthens our argument that pets prevent ATP. And so in that study, what they found was that it's very clear, yes, dose matters. And so when you have five dogs in the house, it is virtually impossible to develop ATP. A little bit more likely to as soon as you have fewer and fewer pets. And then when you go down to zero, ATP becomes more likely to develop. Now, does that mean you must have a pet in the home in order to prevent ATP? No, it doesn't. It just means you still need to make sure you have some form of innate immune activation. And so again, how to do that? That's that question again. How do you dial in the microbiome? I mean, that's a hard thing to do. But yes, I would say having a pet, as far as the evidence that we have out there, having a pet in the first year of life does seem to protect against ATP.
And to some extent also involves a time window, as with some of the other things we've looked at, like food allergies.
Exactly. That first year is crucial. And remember, you know, and that's the thing, Paul, that's so interesting, is that innate immune activation, if it's not happening right away, it seems to matter much less later. So if you don't have a dog in that first year of life or a cat, and then you introduce a cat 3 years later, well, then that child may be, if that is an atopic child, they may be more likely to develop cat allergy. That's not really known, but that's something that we could postulate. Certainly it's not protective if it's introduced at that time. Once ATP develops, once that innate immunity is not activated, ATP develops, your body kind of figures out more and more things to be allergic to, and putting an animal in the house doesn't necessarily mean tolerance. It's actually another question I get fairly frequently in the clinic. Well, okay, so I have this cat allergy. What if I live with a cat? Will they eventually become tolerant to that cat? And, you know, I've had some patients who have said it doesn't bother them anymore, and that's fair. But in terms of what we know, there's no evidence to suggest that having a cat in the house prevents development of or reverses atopic cat allergy. In fact, what I see in clinic all day and much more commonly is, I know I've had cat allergy. We have a cat in the house now. I've given it a year or two, and it is awful, and it's only gotten worse. So that tends to be what we see. It's that first year in immunologic development that's just crucial.
Busy hands are happy hands, right?
That's right. That's the immune system. That's how it wants to be.
If it doesn't have a chore, it'll just spend all of its day doing screen time and running with the wrong
The familiar story.
Thanks again for your expertise. I hope we get to talk again. I hope we get to have lunch sometime, but I hope we can talk again, because you're always a great guest. Thanks for being with us. Amara, thanks so much for recommending this topic. Thanks for your very insightful question today. And for all of our listeners, please feel free to send your comments, your recommendations for topics, your questions, your concerns. And just think of this as being Dear Abby for the pediatric crowd. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.